Kia ora and welcome to Better Off Red. I'm Pip and this is episode 13. Bum bum bum. I guess with such a dark number, it's probably appropriate that we're dealing with a dark book. Sue Orr and I got together to talk about Vladimir Nabokov's Lolita, a troubling book, a book which has troubled me, a book that is troubling largely because it's a beautiful book about a hideous person and hideous acts, and yeah, it's a troubling book. Sue and I really enjoyed talking to Sue. She blew my mind, you know. I think that's what happens every time I do one of these episodes on a book that I've read and thought about, and then through the conversations, I'm so grateful for the conversations, through the conversations someone will say something that'll just make me go, oh. And that moment came in this interview when you know, I trouble at this book, and I trouble at, you know, what happens with this book in your mind. And Sue made this really good point about how once this consciousness is in your brain, it's very hard. It challenges a lot of the things that we take as normal concerning the portrayal of young girls and young women and women as a whole. And it's very hard to sort of accept some things that were spoon-fed as normal through the media once you've read this book and had some time with this awful, awful consciousness. Anyway, Sue is a wonderful writer. She's a wonderful talker as well. I really enjoyed talking with her. And she's doing some really interesting research as part of her PhD, which we got to talk about as well. So, yeah. Oh, and thank you for the people that are rating us on iTunes. Yay! Really appreciate it, and appreciate you listening, and thank you. Bye-bye.
Part 1. Lolita, light of my life, fire of my loins, my sin, my soul, Lolita. The tip of the tongue taking a trip of 3 steps down the palate to tap at 3 on the teeth. Lolita. She was low, plain low in the morning, standing 4'10" in one sock. She was Lola in slacks. She was Dolly at school. She was Dolores on the dotted line. But in my arms, she was always Lolita. Did she have a precursor? She did. Indeed she did. In point of fact, there might have been no Lolita at all had I not loved, one summer, a certain initial girl child. In a Princeton by the sea. Oh, when? Oh, about as many years before Lolita was born as my age was that summer. You can always count on a murderer for a fancy prose style. Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, exhibit number 1 is what the serifs, the misinformed, simple, noble-winged serifs, envied. Look at this tangle of thorns. 2. I was born in 1910 in Paris. My father was a gentle, easygoing person, a salad of racial genes, a Swiss citizen of mixed French and Austrian descent, with a dash of the Danube in his veins. I'm going to pass around in a minute some lovely glossy blue picture postcards. He owned a luxurious hotel on the Riviera. His father and 2 grandfathers had sold wine, jewels and silk, respectively. At 30, he married an English girl, daughter of Jerome Dunn, the alpinist, and granddaughter of 2 Dorset parsons, experts in obscure subjects, paleopedology, alien hearts, respectively. My very photogenic mother died in a freak accident, picnic, lightning, when I was 3, and, save for a pocket of warmth in the darkest past, nothing of her subsists within the hollows and dells of memory. Over which, if you can still stand my style, I'm writing under observation, the sun of my infancy had set. Surely you all know those redolent remnants of day suspended with the midges about some hedge in bloom, or suddenly entered and traversed by the rambler at the bottom of a hill in the summer dusk, a furry warmth, golden midges.
So, I am sitting at my dining room table with Sue Orr, which is marvellous. How are you, Sue?
I'm good.
That's very good. We both have a copy of Lolita in our hands. She's wearing bobby socks in both cover. I'll probably take a photo of that. That's quite... Ugh.
Yeah.
As usual, I will start with where I heard about this book. I have an embarrassing story about this book. I liked The Police when I was a child, the rock band with Sting. There's a line in Don't Stand So Close to Me that says, just like that old man in the book by Nabokov. Yeah. And I looked up to find out what that book was.
Yeah.
And so at about 15, I read this book. The one memory I have of it is that I had a piece of paper that I was using as a bookmark that I had to write all the words that I didn't understand into it, because I didn't understand a lot of words in this book, and they weren't necessarily words to do with, you know, experiences I haven't had, that they were, you can hear it even in the excerpt that you read. While I was doing my PhD, I came back to it because I think Nabokov has an interesting relationship to things.
Yeah.
And I sort of came to it through a couple of other things and read it again and was just taken. Even though I'd read the book before, I had this preconception about what the book was like. But when I read it again, I was blown away. I'd read Pale Fire. I'd read a lot of, I like him a lot. Mm. But reading this again, I was shocked at how kind of evil it is.
Yeah.
It's interesting. How did you first come across this book?
I think I came across it probably in my mid-20s. I'd heard of it before. And of course, as you say, it's kind of referenced in popular culture and has been for a long time. And so there was this connotation around the name, the name Lolita. Even though as a child, or not as a child, but as a younger person, when I'd heard the name, even though I hadn't read the book, just the sound of that name suggested something disturbing to me. And it was really, and eventually, of course, you find out about the book. And when I read it, so I did. I mean, it had been sitting on my bookshelf as a book that I was always going to read. And then one day I sat down and I opened it. And I just didn't move until I'd finished it.
Yeah.
I plunged into it. It was like plunging into a... toxic river that you couldn't find the bank to climb out of. And you know, obviously reading it in the 20s, you knew it was toxic, and I emerged at the end of the reading, and you know, probably at the end of the day that I read it, feeling highly disturbed by it, but having also having had to concede that as a reader, there's no way I could have stopped reading or put it down.
Yeah, and I mean, this is I like that line about a murderer needing a beautiful style or something. Mm. Like, it's absolutely hypnotic, and it's such an evil game to play, isn't it?
Yes.
Like, it's a really, really horrible game to play, and I mean, I think there are really simplistic reasons to say why you would play a game like that, but I think it's more complex than that. I don't know what I'm trying to say, but yeah, and it's interesting, that disturbingness, because I remember when I read it, you know, as a 15-year-old, a lot of it just went over my head. Mm. I remember the one thing that I took away from that is the tongue and the eye, you know, getting eyelash out of the eye. And to me, I thought, I was really confused. I was kind of like, is that sexy? Is it gross? Is it, you know? But then when you come to read it, by the time you're at that point, everything is so, it's just so crazy. I love that idea of a toxic river. Mm. I think that's a really interesting idea.
Mm. And I think it's the his masterful use of prose. And I mean, even in that little bit at the start there, you have such vivid imagery. Nature's there as well, and the whole kind of fertility of life, and that kind of it kind of sets the scene up for a story about a child who's nowhere yet near womanhood, except you have a narrator who's just waiting for her to come along, and you know, ironically, it doesn't want her to be a woman. He wants her to be a child forever. But it's very heavy with, it's very heavy with fertility, that whole sense of things waiting to explode and waiting to ripen, people and things and places, and
it's so interesting that, you know, like, that's one of the things that I always am astounded by, it is that thing, the absolute, how am I going to put it, it's so fraught, isn't it, but the way that the narrator is in complete control of the portrayal of Lolita.
Yes.
You know, like the idea that, you know, you know, over and over again, it's her that's the nymph, you know, like,
yes,
she's the one that, you know, like, it's, if only she wouldn't be X or Y,
yes,
or, you know, and what I really loved about that second reading that I did in, you know, a couple of years ago, was that I really loved how, like, it's such a trite term, but how his narration becomes unreliable.
Yes.
Like, if you've got a certain amount of, you know, I don't know, like, maturity or whatever, that reading becomes really, you know, he lets on something about himself that he doesn't mean to, I think.
That's right.
I don't know, yeah.
I agree. And in fact, he gave a lecture. I was just reading a Martin Amis essay this morning on all of his work, but he focuses on Lolita, and he's saying, the author says at one point in a lecture when he was teaching, he said, no book is ever read, it's always reread.
Oh, wow.
And I thought that's really, he knew this book would be reread by its readers.
Mm.
And I have to say, as a reader personally, I don't often read a book twice.
Yeah, I'm the same.
Because there are so many good books out there to be read in
so
little time. But he sensed when he wrote it that people would have to come back to it to try and make sense of the world, his world within the book. But this is something that hit me, because I've read this book again this week in preparation for our chat, and I started to think this book will be read through ages of social perspective. And it's organic. It will just always keep growing with the society that it lands in and times that it lands in. So to read this book now, it's a horrendous biography of a paedophile. And you talk about that unreliable narrator, and that's, you know, the unreliability of him is a really, that's a really striking feature of reading it in this day and age.
Yeah.
Because he has convinced, he tries to convince the reader that it was all her fault.
Yeah,
And right up to the point where he discovers, when he first finally has, well, he rapes her, that, actually she'd already had sex, you know. And so if people reading this, I remember reading reviews of it, because it came out in the mid-50s.
Yeah.
So it was kind of like, actually, you know, there are little girls like that around.
Good God.
And to have that thought now, you would never have that thought if you came to this the first time round.
Yeah.
You'd go, no, this guy not only thinks that he can get off the hook by saying, well, she wasn't a virgin at 12, but that we would believe him that he's not making that up.
Yeah.
You know, like, I think the unreliability of the narrator in this will continue to grow as time goes on.
Yeah.
And people understand paedophilia and sexual abuse more thoroughly.
Yeah. Yeah. I was just thinking about that, you know, like, it's interesting because if you think about the 50s and the place of the woman in society, and that, and you know, that's one of the things I always find so chilling about it, is his relationship to her mother, you know, and the absolute hate, the absolute hatred of a mature woman, you know, like, of the body of a mature woman, of the, and I just think that's interesting as well, because, you know, like, I don't know, like, every now and then I see, you know, trashy romance novels or trashy novels from that era, and you know, it will be sort of like, you know, she was too old, or this is that, or you know, and there's a lot of that misogyny kind of in there, and I think I really like that idea that the reading will grow, you know, like, that it was sort of, because I think the 19, like, because it had trouble being published,
yes, like, it
had immense trouble being published,
and in the end it was published by a publisher of erotica, and he claimed that he wasn't quite aware that that's the kind of publisher they were, which is unbelievable. And it's interesting that his other novels have all gone into that kind of the nymph, you know, he as a writer, he was obviously thinking about children in a sexual context constantly, because his other works are, you know, I forget, is it The Enchanter is almost identical in the first, I haven't actually read it, but I've read that it is almost identical in the first half to Lolita.
Yeah.
So he couldn't take his mind away from that.
Yeah.
So, you know, he would have known who he was publishing with, I'm sure.
Because I think that is one of the interesting things is like, you know, like I just, it's interesting because when we were talking about unreliable narrator and I was thinking, oh yeah, maybe we're more educated to the unreliable narrator, you know, and I was thinking about how this book put in motion, you know, like it's kind of put in motion similar kind of books, but I was thinking there are very few that would align with a pedophile. Yes. You know what I mean? Like I was just thinking back, the only, oh, now I can't remember the name of it, but I was just thinking back and I was thinking, yeah, murderer, there's a lot of sort of psycho killer kind of ones, and you know, he identifies himself, you know, the narrator identifies himself as a murderer, and you know, it's interesting how, yeah, I was just trying to think of a similar sort of contemporary text, and I couldn't really.
I can't, you know, I've read a lot of first person narratives.
Yeah.
And I'm becoming more and more convinced as time goes on that it's a very special writer who can cope with first person narration. And a lot of the time it doesn't work because there's a whole lot of self-analysis that has to go on. If someone's talking about how I felt constantly for 300 pages of a novel, it can get pretty tiresome to be reading.
Yeah.
Whereas this is, it's a given that he's convinced his readers, and he's convincing himself as well. This narrator is convinced himself as well.
Yeah.
And I think that's really interesting. It's so self-assured and the sick space that he's in, that, you know, I'll tell you everything you want to know, everything that happened, not a problem.
And I think it was really interesting because, again, this week rereading it, like that idea, I totally forgot about the what do you call it, like the kind of framing there, you know, the story, the reason that I'm writing it, you know, like I'm being watched while I'm writing, and you know, I was just thinking how that doesn't ever feel clunky, and whereas, like, I think, you know, like if, you know, books are often like that. Like, if you tell someone the idea of a book, you're kind of like, oh, that sounds dumb. But, you know, like, I was just thinking about how the artifice, is that what it is? It's kind of like the mechanics of it, isn't it?
Yes.
It's like, you'll never be allowed to forget that I'm writing this, you know, that this is, I am the writer of this work. It's not like I'm standing on a stage or walking around and deciding things. And I think that technically is so clever.
It is clever. And how he slips, it is first person, but when he kind of, he's so stylized that frequently he slips into observing himself. So all of a sudden you'll switch over and you go, our dear old Humbert.
Mm.
So he's looking at himself in the story too. And so he's absolutely the narrator. And I always think the implied author here is absolutely in control of everything. The stylization is just incredible.
Because that's what I think is so interesting as well, is that there is this control, you know, like, and it reeks of the control, yet things are still slipping out, which I think is so, I don't know, and that's why I wonder about, you know, like, if this was, because he is the sickest of the sick, like, I think, I don't know what it was like when the book was written, but it seems like that, you know, that behavior is kind of like the worst of the worst, the monster of the monsters. It seems to play with that, you know, like it seems to say, you know, there's going into it, there's this implied idea from outside, from the outside world and the morals of the outside world that this man, you know, will let things slip, you know. And I think that kind of weird contract that there is with the reader, it's, because that's what I was interested in. I was thinking, when I was reading it, I was thinking, what is it about this that's so compelling? Do you have any ideas on that?
Well, like, I think it's the sustained manipulation of words. But so, you know, the books that people are talking about now, you know, the 50 Shades of Grey or whatever, it doesn't matter what's in a book. If the writing's really bad, then you're just not going to read it. Whereas, if this was a story about something else, anything else, I mean, his mastery of prose is, I think that's what's compelling, and in terms of reading on, because really, there are actually very few surprises in this book.
Yeah, yeah.
You know at the
yeah.
start, I mean, you know at the start that she's dead and she died in childbirth, and you know by reading the back cover what's going to happen. And in fact, it's really funny, I've, you know, over the time looking at the different reviews that have come out at the time of first publication, if you're looking for sex scenes, you won't find them.
No.
And there's, I don't think there's a swear word in this book.
No.
So if you're looking for kind of that kind of thrill, it ain't there. And so it's, I think what's compelling is the journey into his mind, the narrator's mind.
Because that's what I was thinking as well. Like, I was thinking, we were looking at Flowers in the Attic last night, and we were joking about how you find yourself siding with the brother-sister relationship. You're like, oh, I hope they get together, you know. Yeah. And but this book doesn't. Never sided with them. And I was thinking that is kind of a lame trick that sometimes these books play. You know, they're kind of like, you know, I'm just the misunderstood psycho killer. Or, you know, like, oh, poor me.
Yeah.
Whereas I never once thought, oh, I hope Humbert gets away with it. You know, like I just...
Yeah.
And I just think that is interesting because, you know, people are often laboured about... We have to relate to the lead character, and we have to empathize and all that. And I think, yeah, you're right. It's the journey into the mind and the consciousness, and just the absolute. I don't feel like there's been. I don't know. Maybe I'm just not well read enough. I don't feel like there's ever been another writer quite like him again.
No, I agree.
And I just and I've picked apart to see what that's about.
Yeah.
But. Yeah, I don't know. What do you think?
Like there are places, like as examples of this stylized, this mastery of the prose. He, you know, I've made some little marks here. So at one stage, because they're on a road journey, he's on the run basically with her in the car.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think it's like so. Here, for example, page 158, he gives a little kind of. It's almost like a travel diary of where they went, and it's pages and pages long. We went here, we went there, because they're crossing the states in a car. And then he just drops in, you know, and they talk about we had rows, major and minor, and the biggest one happened in Virginia and Park Avenue, and we were arguing. And how long did I think we were going to live in stuffy cabins doing filthy things together and never behaving like ordinary people? So he's dropped that in there. And then he goes on, and then he talks about hitchhikers they went past. And then now and again, he just drops this bomb. So you're kind of seduced into reading a road trip. And that goes on long and a long time. And so you really are, you're visualising these places because he describes them well. And then... So they've gone past a hitchhiker, and then he just breaks it. So can I just read this little bit?
Yeah, that'd be great.
So I'll just finish. We went past the college student displaying the grime of vocational outdoor work as proudly as the name of the famous college arching across the front of his sweatshirt, the desperate lady whose battery had just died on her, the clean-cut, glossy-haired, shifty-eyed, white-faced young beasts in loud shirts and coats, vigorously thrusting out tense thumbs to tempt lone woman or sad sack salesman with fancy cravings. "Let's take him," Lo would often plead, rubbing her knees together in a way she had, as some particularly disgusting pollex, some man of my age and shoulder breadth, with a face a clerk of an unemployed actor, walked backwards practically in the path of our car. It's just like, it just sends shivers down my spine, you know, because all of a sudden he just, boom, reminds us he's got a child captive in his car and she is beside herself trying to get away from him.
Yeah,
yeah.
And I think...
And he does that often.
And I think, that is the weird struggle in the book. Well, I don't know. I don't even know if it is a struggle, but that weird thing of normality forcing in on this, you know, it just seems, you know, like it just seems so hideous. You know, I mean, that's it. It kind of like that bit you read. I often think of Lynch when I think of this book. Like that idea that. Yeah, like there's just something slightly off. You know, it's completely off.
Yeah.
But there's just something slightly off. Yeah. And that idea of you get that sense that people are looking in from the outside as well. You know, like that there are people watching.
That's right.
It's really freaky.
Yeah.
And there is, I mean, like I don't know how you feel about this, but I'd be really interested the PhD that you're working on the moment is looking at voyeurism and eavesdropping, And I my memory of this book, and, you know, from rereading it, I feel there is that person that's watching, isn't there? Well, is that an imagined person? You know, like, there is that weird kind of... Do you want to talk about that?
I think that's really interesting, because the novel I've been writing is concerned with collective knowledge, collective illicitly obtained knowledge. So as a community, if everyone knows something but you're not supposed to know, it's a secret, then that where does that leave the onus to put things right? If everyone knows and no one's saying, the onus on the individual kind of dissipates. If they're not doing anything about it, I won't be the one to do something about it, kind of thing.
Yeah,
that's the territory I'm interested in my own writing at the moment. And that's the other thing, that's the most amazing thing about the chronicle of the road trip going on and on and on. In my mind, when I see that, when I read that passage, you can read it from the narrator's point of view. He's looking out going, you know, well, there's all these people and we don't care about them, me and my Lolita. But in fact, are those people looking in?
Yes, yes.
You know,
what
are they seeing?
Yeah.
And to be travelling across the states and no one thinks that's all a bit odd. Because, and what's doubly amazing is that he invites us, with that little interjection from Lolita saying, can we please pick him up? He's inviting us to see that her humanity and her situation. But then after, he goes on to say, well, we won't be picking men up because you'll be seducing them too.
Yeah.
You know, so it's doubly manipulative of the reader.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think, I mean, that idea of collective knowing, like, one of the really interesting things about the book is that all of this might be my opinion, and I totally, you can disagree, but it's weird how he's kind of hiding in plain sight.
Yes.
Like, he is, there's a social contract that says we will not kill people's mothers and sleep with them, you know, like, yes. there's kind of a social contract where if a man says, this is my daughter, I need a room for a night, people will agree with that. And I think that's what's so interesting about the territory you're talking about.
Yes.
You know, like, there is this weird politeness and staying out of people's business, yet in the same way we're kind of in people's business as well, eh?
Yeah.
Like, it's really odd.
I guess the things we have to talk about, I agree with you, is the time he wrote it in the mid-50s, whether the population, and this is a gross generalisation, but imagine if a man was travelling with his daughter across the states in a car and kept checking into hotels and motels. He said, I'm with my daughter and I need a room for the night. Whether the consciousness of the population would even go there.
Yeah, yeah.
So maybe not. I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, it's before I was born. But so maybe we're talking about that kind of post-war innocence, euphoria, you know, the American dream.
Yeah.
And so those kinds of thoughts did not cross people's minds.
Because I was just thinking about, there's the neighbours, eh? Like,
yes.
And they're, you know, like, the car accident's a fluke. Like, you know, that they couldn't have asked for a better, you know, like, I mean, you know,
how,
like, that was how fortuitous for Hummit. But, you know, like, it's really interesting, that whole, because, I don't know, like, your novel sounds so interesting with this. I'm just thinking about suburban life, and I know it's rural, but that idea of communities that live closer and closer together, and just, it's kind of interesting, eh? Like, because there's an overhearing of a telephone call in here, isn't there? Like, does he overhear the mother?
Yes, there is.
Yeah, like, the mother kind of,
I bookmarked it for my own research, but I'm not sure just whether I can, I'm not sure whether I page marked it this morning. Was it there? Yes, no, sorry, I can't find it.
Yeah. Because there is that, you know, like there is that weird, I don't know, like I'm really interested in how technology lets you know, like there's that weird thing where, you know, without the telephone, that would be a conversation that would have taken place face to face, which would have meant more privacy in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, the telephone's kind of interesting, eh?
Yeah.
Because your novel deals a little bit with that as well.
Yes, eh? Well, its central motif is the old party line, which is a, you know, was a practical tool in a rural community, but was also a, you know, you could listen in on other people's conversations, and you had this one central, you know, and it gave the telephone operator, the person who put the calls through, the ultimate power. She knew everything about everybody, and I'm just I was interested in, you know, you can listen in, but it's then what you do with that information
which
really matters.
Yeah, it's so true. And that's the sense. I really like that thing you said about the car rolling through, because when I think about this book, the image I get is kind of like one of those Patrick Crudson photographs where you're looking in a motel room. Yeah. You know, like you're kind of out here looking in and you're kind of looking into the car. And it's that weird thing how, even though we're right in his consciousness, there's a distancing. Yes. And I wonder, you know, when you read the language takes some unpicking, doesn't it? You know, like it's not conversational prose, it's not, you know, that kind of thing. And I really enjoy that play with distance.
Mm.
I don't know, I just find the language astounding.
It's really interesting because he did an interview in The Art of Fiction and the first question posed to him, I forget who was doing the interviewing, but it was like, you are so obsessed as a writer with public morality. And he said, I couldn't care less about public morality. Mm. I don't care about it. I care, my narrator cares about it. But that's that distance thing, you know. So he would maintain that, you know, this was the interest of Umbert and Bear. It's not my interest. And you feel that kind of stepping back of responsibility. You have that in the book, but you have that from the author as well.
Yeah,
you
know, it's a really
it leaves you in a really uncomfortable kind of void about what he, why he continued to write these kind of books, what kept bringing him back there.
Yeah, because it is, you know, I mean, I'm always interested in writers, or what writers say about their writing, because often it's the least true, you know, like, it's kind of like, so it doth protest too much. And I think, you know, like, I don't know, like, it's that weird thing where I've sort of kept him as a personality quite distant from my reading of his work, and I think, I don't know why I've done that.
Well,
like, I'm
you
very...
Might be protecting your respect for him.
Yeah.
You don't want to know. Totally.
I want to be a good guy. Yeah, but, you know, like, I do, you know, one of the things I do enjoy reading him talking about is translation, you know, and like, I was really, you know, his Eugene Onegin, and, you know, like, that idea of, you know, the translation of, you know, one language to another. Mm. And that's, it's quite interesting, because Humbert's from overseas, isn't he? He's not an American-born... Or he's American-born,
well,
but he's...
Yeah, American-born... Oh, no, born in England, did they say?
Yeah.
What does he say? A racial salad.
Yeah, a racial salad. Which is kind of an interesting... I don't know, that's kind of interesting as well. Like, I wonder if that is particular to the language and the way, you know, that kind of... I don't know, like, I imagine, you know... himself maybe learning about American culture and about it, you know, and you get that kind of observer effect as well.
And this very arch style of slipping into French all the time, and I mean, you know, there's no reason for him to do that. And even when he's having his big fight, his big shootout, his ridiculous shootout scene with Coulty at the end, they're shouting at each other in French. Well, why would they be doing that? And that's just the author being so playful. And that is, you know, it's kind of like metafiction or something. It's kind of, why would they be doing that? You've just told us this huge long story, and you've got these two characters. Neither of them are French shouting at each other. It's a farce. It's actually a real farce.
Completely.
Yeah, except you've been seduced by the previous 289 pages, and you just don't care. You don't care you've been played with as a reader at all.
No, and I think, and I was just thinking, you know, and that as well, like, that is the final, you know, awful act of the real author on Humbert, yeah. You know, because what it is, yeah, like, I mean, there you go. You know, you're very concerned with what people think.
Mm.
You want to be the hero of this. Mm. You've done this magnificent shootout, and then you've stupidly done it all in front, you know, like, you've changed it to, you idiots, you know. Yeah. And I just think, I wonder if there is a kind of comeuppance in that kind of way for him. Like, I mean, obviously there's the ultimate, you know, he's caught, and, you know, like, and, you know, it's so,
The other thing is, and it was something I saw, you know, Martin Amis had a hit on this essay. He said that for the narrator, there are two undisputable punishments, or, you know, not redemption, it's the opposite of redemption, but it's he gets his comeuppance. He says the fact that Lolita eventually dies in childbirth, and we know that on the first page, the prologue. But he evokes, and I found this really interesting, that after Lolita escapes, he's haunted by dreams of his two ex-wives coming back in these macabre bedroom scenes. And he evokes the image of Jewish woman being taken to the gas chambers. And Amos's view is that evoking that image, calling that into play, is the ultimate... and these are the dreams he's having, and he has them all the time. He can't get rid of them. And he said to have gone into that space as punishment is a clear signal from Nabokov that he paid. To be left with those dreams, nothing could be worse than that. Just to have kind of evoked the Holocaust symbol. And so in a way, that's the author saying to us, I do understand what I've done here. I find that really interesting.
Yeah, me too. Because, I mean, this is the thing. I don't know. Like, there's so much... I just keep coming back to the fact... Like, I don't know. What am I trying to say? I keep coming back to this thing where, you know, like, why does this book just do it for me all the time? And I just think that it is that... It's that joy of the play, and the joy of the... There's something about the darkness that is attractive. Yeah, I don't know. I often think about it, because I often, you know, like, there are people that have said to me certain things shouldn't be written about, and, you know, But there's something about this that just seems... I don't know. And, you know, I think it is the craft and the machine of it. I don't know.
Yeah, I know.
What do you reckon? Why do you think people still read it?
I think for all the reasons we've been talking about, it is so complex and it is so open to interpretations according to the head of the reader, but according to the time.
Yeah.
I just think it will just always be read, and people will always find new things in it.
Yeah.
You know, and as time goes on and we as a society function, however we're going to evolve in the way we look after our children, and that ever and I think terrifying as a society, the sexualisation of young girls, right down to the age of models and the way they're dressed in Sunday magazines. I just think those things are just going to keep interacting with this book to make it, I think, you know, it's just going to always be read.
Yeah.
And read with fresh eyes and with a fresh tingle down the back by people who will be thinking about things that we're yet to think about.
This is an absolute epiphany to me, because I just, yeah, it never occurred to me how it resounds in media. You know, like, when you, and especially when you think about it now, like, just, yeah, it never, the idea of the nymphet, I don't know, is that what he calls them?
Nymphlets.
Nymphet, yeah. The idea of that, and then every time, that seems so rife at the moment. Yes. Like, I mean, it's just hideous. I mean, look at
this cover. This could be, this could be the bottom half of a fashion shoot that you would see in a Saturday or Sunday. And not a trashy magazine, a daily newspaper.
No.
Bobby socks, sandals, short skirt, you know, the legs obviously of a child.
Yeah.
Not a child that's begun to develop And you can just imagine that if this was a full picture, she'd be wearing a sweet blouse and,
yeah,
you know.
And there's that hideous kind of, that, like, I don't know, like, I've been thinking about this a little bit, and it's probably quite controversial, but just the idea that this obsession with skinniness is often, yes, about stunted development, yes, as well, you know, like, yeah, models with... I've been looking, the thing that I'm working on at the moment deals a lot with fashion, and I've been looking a lot at sort of the Face magazine from the 80s, but also a lot of stuff now, and this idea of no breasts, you know, the idea of a thigh gap, the idea of sort of skinny arms, shaved armpits, you know, shaved genitals, you know, like, this whole idea, it does seem to be this, you can't look at that and read this book and feel okay about it.
No.
Like, that was the thing I was really surprised, and you know, speaking about covers, like this cover, I've been looking at a fashion shoot that was done last year where the pose is almost identical to the cover on my book, which is a young girl, arms up, legs apart, you know. Yeah. I'll take photos so that people can see them. But, and I just think, you know, it's never, God, you've just given me something that's just blowing my mind a little bit, because, you know, like, I've never thought of that. Like, it is impossible to read this book and then consume that kind of media naively again, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, let's not kid ourselves where it's going.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, because it is, I mean, yeah, it is so interesting. Because like what you're saying with that, you know, like the photo on your book, you know, that idea of skinny legs and free posture, you know, even the posture of a youth, you know, of a child, yeah.
Mm. Oh my God. And it just reinforces aspects of how evil the contents of the book are, because... You know, he's paying her, you know, he's one of the most horrendous sentences in here talks about having strenuous sex twice a day with Lolita. And she gets tickets to the movies and ice creams and lollipops.
Yeah.
And so it's that double manipulation of the reader. So I've seen reviews that have said, this is a laugh out loud book.
Whoa.
Because it's so funny that this happened, and you know, she's not being abused, she's abusing him.
Oh,
and you know,
God.
and to ever be able to read the book and think that is, I mean, you know, hopefully those
because
reviewers
they
have passed on
somewhere
or
gone somewhere else.
Yeah, but I mean,
that is the risk you make, hey?
Yes.
Like, I mean, this is what I was thinking. Recently read, again, Lazy Boys by Carl Schuchar. You know, like, this is the risk you make. Like, if you do... take someone inside the consciousness of a mind that is not, I don't know what you'd call it, evil, you know, evil, you know, like, you do risk, you know, that, you know, like, I read a review by Dougal McNeil about Lazy Boys, and it was saying that it's sort of been taken on as sort of a frat book in an American university. It's kind of like, whoa, you know, and, you know, I feel like, you know, and I guess as a writer... Yeah, that weird thing about responsibility.
Yeah.
God. I mean, you know, like that, you know, like everybody wants to write like everyone's dead and it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
And I think, yeah, I don't know. Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. But yeah, I think you're so right. Like, and I think that was a really good demonstration as well. That idea of road trip, absolute fucking kick it in the guts there.
There's another one. I just...
Oh yeah, that'd be great.
And it's when they've stopped, and I think by this stage Claire Quilty is following them quite persistently, and the car does, and Lolita, they stop in a little town and Lolita disappears, and it's not for very long. They're in a tiny town and she comes back, and Humbert says, well, where have you been? And she went, I went over there and had a look in the window, shop window, and prove it to me what was in the window. And then they walk over and it's, you know. And in fact, what she's done is, I think she's gone away and made a phone call.
Mm.
But, and then so we have this, again, it's almost this fairy tale. 1, 2, 3. Where did you go next? I went here. Let's go there. And then where did you go? I went here. It's, you know, it's like Goldilocks and the Three Bears.
Yeah.
And the kind of childish narrative. And then we get, this. So I said nothing. I put the pad back, closed the compartment and drove out of Wace, I'm not sure if I pronounce that right. Lowe had grabbed some comics from the back seat and sat, mobile white blouse, one brown elbow out of the window, and was deep in the current of an adventure of some clout or clown. 3 or 4 miles out, I turned into the shadow of a picnic ground where the morning had dumped its litter of light on an empty table. Lowe looked up with a semi-smile of surprise, and without a word, I delivered a tremendous backhand cut that caught her smack on her hot, hard little cheekbone. It's just like,
I know.
Pulls over and just beats her.
Yeah.
You know, and she, and it's, you know, we never see her suffer for that. She just goes on. It's almost like she's one of these little dolls.
Yeah.
You know, a porcelain doll.
Because this is the thing that I had forgotten that I found so tricky about the book is that the Dolores that starts and the girl that ends is just so, it's just unbelievably horrible.
Yes.
And you know that, you know, the wisecracking kind of you're a dick, you know.
Yeah.
Like that arrogance of,
yeah,
teenageness, and how he kind of brings that into subservience.
Yeah.
And you know, this it's also quite a good, you know, like when you read that, it kind of, you know, that thing of, oh, why didn't she just leave, and why didn't,
yeah,
she just do that, and you know, it's a really good sort of biography of that as well. And and I just, and then her end, you know, like it's just so, it's so shocking, and you can't help but I wonder if that's what it is, like if through the book it's not him, you know, he's thinking you're siding with him, but really, you know, where the empathy lies is with her, right?
With her, and yet he doesn't give us access to her.
No,
we never see anything from her point of view.
No.
She is an object,
yeah,
that he's carting around the countryside.
Yeah.
And he reduces her actually cleverly, and most, and I feel, you know, as a reader, I wanted her to get some kind of ultimate vengeance on him.
Yeah.
And then I realized that that's not going to happen.
Yeah.
And then, you know, in some perverse way, I thought, maybe if she went and killed herself.
Yes, yes.
As a reader, we would feel that satisfaction of the tragedy.
Yeah.
But she writes him a letter, says, you're my father, give me some money.
Yeah.
You know, and he turns up and he gives her the money. And so he leaves us, again, he leaves us in this uncomfortable void.
Yeah.
Of feeling about what Umbea has reduced her to,
yeah,
you know, and she's not, he's not going to satisfy her and have her kill herself, you know. He's just turned her into she's still not a person, she's still not a empathetic person.
No.
At the end.
No.
She never develops,
and that's, I mean, that is, I mean, that's that's quite hardcore, not to let your reader off the hook.
That's,
you
right,
know, like, and that I think is, I mean, that out of everything, I think takes the chutzpah, you know what,
yes,
I mean? Like, I think, you know, like, and that's why I find this so enduring and so much more, what's the word I'm looking for? So much more compelling and less icky. I don't,
yeah,
know, icky, that's a new word I've invented.
Yeah.
But, you know, like, some of those other books that I read that are about dark psychologies, they seem to use the narrative to tidy it up.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean? Like the,
yes,
narrative, you know, like, you know, that he gets it in the end, someone dies in the end, you know, like it's that real, you know, whereas in here, what he seems to do is he's got such an understanding of that storytelling thing that you are left just, oh my God, you know what,
yeah,
I mean? Like, you know, she doesn't even get, you know, it's not like the awakening where you,
no,
walk into the water, you know, there's,
yeah,
not even the romance of that.
No.
You know, she's a sad figure at the end,
yeah,
you know, she's, and yeah, it's, I don't know, like, I think it's that thing where you've got form and content just so, I mean, it's a real old fashioned idea, but that idea of just form and content acting like this absolute cog, and,
yes,
you know, like, it's just,
and yet
so
a frisson between them as well.
Yes,
so
yes,
they're,
yes,
not, they're not ever, you talk about two cogs, they're not ever going to lock in.
No, no.
They're kind of going to crash.
Yeah.
And they crash right till the very end.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And I was just thinking, like, you know, the enjoyment for me of that is immense.
Yes,
and
me too.
And I just don't, I was thinking, I don't know why, but I just find that I love dissonance. I don't know if that's the right word,
yeah,
but I love it when things aren't melodic, when,
yeah,
things are, like, crashing against,
yeah,
each other. And I think it's because that disturbance, that's where my mind gets changed, if you know what I mean. Like, if something is humming along and it's as I expected, you know, like I can, because like you say, this is such a different book. If there is the big romantic gesture at the end of her killing herself, you know, or her getting a happy life, or you know, whatever, there's it settles and you can forget the book. Do you know what I mean?
That's
you go,
right.
Radio,
that's right. Yep.
Last page.
Good read.
Off. Yeah, good read. Let's get going. Whereas this
yeah.
just eats and eats and eats away at
yeah.
you. Ugh.
Yeah.
Jeez. Is that a good thing? I don't know. I think
it's a good thing too.
Yeah,
that's what I want from a book.
Yeah, me too.
I want to be left uncomfortable, still thinking about it, you know, 20-year gaps between readings and still finding new things in it
yeah.
to disturb me.
Yeah, yeah, totally, totally. And I just, yeah, I like I say, you know, I just feel like, I just feel like there has never been a writer like this again.
No.
And I don't, and I, the individual vision of it is just so, like, just that bit you read about how the sunshine's dumped it. So, you know, like, it's
yeah.
just, every time there's, this and the metaphor, I mean the what would you call it, I guess the kind of figurative language, it's always surprising but inevitable, you know
yes.
what I mean, like it's always like, oh, I've never heard it described like that before,
yeah.
but oh of
yeah,
course
of
it's
course.
Described like that,
yeah.
which I just think is so clever,
yeah,
and right from the start, you know, we're set up to say this is a book about language, you
yeah.
know, like here's how Lolita sounds in your la
yeah.
la la, and yeah, it's just so great.
Mm.
Oh my goodness, we've just about done it, have
yeah.
we got anything else to say about
yeah,
it?
Yeah, well I think we could talk about it forever,
yeah,
we?
Yeah, 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 I think
that's,
yeah,
it's that kind of book.
We should come back in another 20 years and talk about it again,
yeah,
but
see
yeah.
how we feel about it,
yeah, yeah. I just think, yeah, I would just say, yeah, read it. Yay. No,
yeah.
that's great. Thank you so much, Sue.
You're welcome. Good to talk about it.
Cool. Yeah.